Our appreciation of the ocean and all the creatures who live there may tend to overlook seaweed. There's a lot of it and a lot of different types, which it turns out have lots of uses. And seaweed gets its due in a book by Susan Hand Shetterly called Seaweed Chronicles, A World at the Water's Edge. Susan Hand Shetterly works to save habitat in rural Maine, where she lives. She's been writing about wildlife and wetlands for three decades plus in articles and books, including several aimed at children. Susan Hand Shetterly, thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange. Maine is your love and your laboratory, too, it would seem. What makes it so good for teaching nature, in your perspective?
Well, it's the place where I learned about nature. When I came here, I was one of the back-to-the-landers in the 70s, and I had had a good education through books in college, but what I began to learn is to pay attention to the outside, and to go and look in books to find the answers, or to ask my neighbors. And the neighbors I worked with, because we lived near the coast, were often fishermen, and I learned from them how they do pay attention. Of course, their lives depended on their plant paying very close attention. So I learned. So Maine was my university.
You were a city kid originally, is that right? A New York City kid?
I was. Then we moved to Connecticut, but and we had 5 acres, which felt huge. But Maine, when we moved here, we built and bought a cabin on 65 acres right near the harbor. So that was where we lived and raised our kids. I know it sounds wonderful, but I have to add very quickly that we didn't have electricity.
Oh, man. So did you burn a lot of wood to stay warm in that Maine winter?
We did, and I had never realized how cold a winter could get.
That's true. Yeah, Maine's
and
a different...
how unfun it is to go out to the outhouse in the middle of winter.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, no electricity, no plumbing either.
That is right.
Wow. So, at the water's edge, was seaweed one of those things that even you didn't notice as subject matter for a while, Susan?
I didn't, because I was putting together, I consider myself an essayist, and I was putting together another book of essays. And I started reading the subjects off to my agent, and she was unusually quiet, which, of course, means that she wasn't very interested.
Right.
And I got to the part about saying I wanted to write about going out with a seaweed harvester and cutting seaweed with her. And my agent said, why don't you write a book about that? And I said, well, there's not very much to say about seaweed. But she said, well, just take a look. So I did. And 5 years later, I've written a book about seaweed. And really, in some ways, it's an introduction. I could write another one. I don't think I will, but I could.
Right, but there's a lot here. You've managed to keep it to a fairly compact book, and a delightful one at that, Seaweed Chronicles, The World at, World at the Water's Edge. Weed, though, just to start right there, is not really accurate. It is algae, but macroalgae, and wow, how many types?
I think you have a lot out on the West Coast. Here in the Gulf of Maine, we think about 250 species, and you have to understand that the phycologists, who are the scientists who study seaweeds, are still counting seaweeds, and they don't really know for sure how many there are. I mean, they're probably in the thousands. And I know that over in Ireland, they have twice as many as we do, but my guess is you, on the California, Oregon coast, that you have more than we do.
There's a lot of stuff that washes up on beaches that has you scratching your head. I'm glad you brought up phycologists. I didn't want to ask a question about that because I was afraid of making a joke about psychologists, but that is somebody who studies seaweed as a phycologist, huh?
Absolutely. And what I want to do is make a plug, if I might, for young people who are thinking of going into botany. you know, in a graduate, postgraduate degree, because we need to find out so much more about seaweed, how it interacts with wildlife, what more things we can use from it, and how to take care of it so that we don't harvest too much. So there's a lot there, and, you know, if I had knew somebody who was going in to get a graduate degree, I might recommend taking a look at it.
All right, a lot of stuff to look at there with seaweeds. So you talked already about the impetus for looking into seaweed was about going out with seaweed harvesters. How much is that practice growing worldwide?
Oh, well, worldwide it is growing. But what is catching up with it very quickly is also seaweed aquaculture. And I was told by a friend of mine that you can see the seaweed gardens off the coasts of China from the air, from space.
You mean the aquaculture? They're the actual growing it out there in the ocean in pens or something?
Yes. Well, they grow it with ropes and great sticks in the ground, and it just spreads forever.
What?
And some of them are very big, but here's the problem with big. Although the Chinese do some wonderful things with.
Hang on a second. We need to take a break, and we'll go there now and
sure.
Come back and get the story from China.
Okay.
Seaweed Chronicles: A World at the Water's Edge, the book by Susan Hand Shetterly. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Susan Hand Shetterly, who considers herself an essayist. She's been living in rural Maine for quite some time now and studying the natural environment around her and writing some books along the way and a lot of articles as well. She wasn't sure there was a book in seaweed, and we can report that she's been disabused of that notion now with a book called Seaweed Chronicles, A World at the Water's Edge. You can join the conversation on the exchange as we talk about seaweed and its many uses and many varieties. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we're just talking about aquaculture in China and big seaweed beds encouraged to grow there. How big?
Right. Big seaweed farms. Well, they're all different sizes, but if you can see some of them from space, they're very big. And the interesting thing is if you look at photographs of this, the workers go through them with motorized boats, and they just go on forever. They're as big as some of the corn and soybean fields of the Midwest. And the problem with some of that, not all of that, I don't mean to say that the Japanese and Chinese are not doing a good job. They do wonderful things. But is the flushing, if the water can be flushed, because if the flushing is sort of slow and sluggish, then the new nutrients don't come in to actually make the seaweeds as nutritively rich as they could be. And so that's something that people are thinking about how to grow seaweeds rather than cut wild seaweeds, and how to do it in a way that gives you, when you buy that seaweed to eat, the very best, cleanest, nutrient-dense seaweed you could possibly buy. Here in Maine, where I live, we have these enormous tides. So the seaweed that's grown by the aquaculturalists and also the wild seaweed can't help but get infusions of nutrient-rich water.
I've seen the tides in Maine. It's crazy. Mud flats in the morning where the boats are all sitting there flopped on their sides. All the boats are floating by the afternoon.
Right. I think you're talking about the Bay of Fundy. But, yeah, you're right. And that is in the Gulf of Maine, by the way. It's up in Canada.
Yeah,
that is where the tides are so huge. It's just startling. But they also are growing seaweeds in aquaculture endeavors and harvesting wild.
So you sound, Susan, the expected cautionary notes in the introduction that because in America we're increasing our seaweed harvest at a time in history after so many fisheries have collapsed, it raises the question, are we approaching the harvest with some sense of sustainability?
Right. That's a question.
Yes.
And I can't necessarily answer that. But what I can say is this. Here, we're very aware that we've lost our valuable fisheries. I mean, for instance, the cod that supposedly built this nation is commercially extinct in the Gulf of Maine right now. So, do we have enough awareness of our history so that we can go ahead and make sure that we're doing things in a sustainable way? And the problem with that is sustainable means different things to different people. So that's another that's another problem.
True, yeah. Sustainable for one person is not for another. Let me come back then to the concept of the flushing, because it's interesting that animals, they move themselves around in the sea to get the maximum nutrients. And it sounds like the reason that seaweed attaches itself to stuff is to make sure that the ocean just moves around it, so it gets its nutrients that way.
Very, yes, absolutely. Here's the thing. If you seaweed is, as you said, seaweeds are algae. And so they're not plants. And so they don't have roots that suck up water and minerals and take them up to the leaves that do the photosynthesis. What they each cell in the seaweed takes in the seawater with the minerals and all the nutrients and does the photosynthesis itself. So the instead of roots, what they many of them have, but not all of them, is a hold fast, and what that does is anchor the seaweed in one place. And then the seaweed reaches up because it wants to reach toward the sun, and it's, you know, it just goes with the storm-tossed waves or the quieter currents. It moves according to the water, and it's taking in all those nutrients, every cell in it.
Wow, that's a busy plant. We're talking about not a plant, though, algae, as we pointed out, macroalgae. Susan Hand Shetterly is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Seaweed Chronicles, A World at the Water's Edge. Do all seaweed or a lot of seaweeds have bladders for buoyancy?
Oh, well, the bladders are very interesting because you will find them on seaweeds that are often in areas that don't have as much storm surge, because when you have water that is really moving around very quickly, that water is moving the seaweed around, so it is all over the place and it can go up and down and everything. It's okay, but when it's a slightly calmer, and I don't really mean calm, but slightly calmer, then you need these buoyancy, these little bubbles of air to lift that plant so it can be as close to the light as it possibly can be.
This is the stuff that we used to pop on the beach as kids, and I'm sure you've done it and
yes.
Your kids have too. Okay, that
yes.
Makes
yes. Yeah.
So I want to come back and talk about a consumption of seaweed for humans. I mean, it sounds like a lot of kinds are not only edible but also nutritious.
Right. Well, that's another discipline that really needs more study. What we can say about seaweeds is this, that, for instance, in Japan, and the Japanese, you know, by any standard, are extraordinarily healthy people, and they do eat seaweed. Some of the seaweed they eat, interestingly, has high arsenic content. But they eat it with tofu, which is soybeans, and cabbage vegetables, you know, like cabbage itself and broccoli and things like that. And those two foods actually inhibit arsenic absorption. And it's so interesting to me that, you know, they didn't do 1,000 years ago, hundreds of years ago, experiments to find out whether the arsenic was incorporated as well into their bodies when they were eating tofu and cabbage, but that somehow they managed to figure this out to have this wonderful balance of food that's the most healthy for them. Here in the United States, we're just beginning to find seaweed something that we want to eat in various ways, in salads and soups and, of course, sushi. And we don't have the enzymes that the Japanese in Japan have. The Japanese who are Americans don't have it either. But, right, so what we don't have are those in flora, intestinal flora. But that doesn't mean the seaweed is just wasted on us, because we can absorb some of the nutrients. But here's the other thing. The things that we can't absorb, the roughage, goes through and it actually cleans out our system. So in that way, it's good for us too.
So even if your body can't particularly pull the stuff out of the seaweed, at least having the seaweed go through you is of some benefit.
It's absolutely beneficial. And also soaking seaweed or boiling it and using some of the water in soups and stuff, you do get the nutrients more easily without, and they're more absorbable. But they've done some recent studies. Tell me when I'm telling you too many studies.
No, this is great.
But they've, oh, okay. Thank you. They've done some recent studies, and they're finding this. This is so interesting to me. If they put seaweeds in food for cows, chickens, and also aquaculturally raised fish, those animals seem to be able to take in the nutrients. And then we eat the animals, and so we get them that way.
We actually talked to a University of California Davis scientist recently who has been putting larger amounts of seaweed into cow feed to reduce the methane-filled burps they put out. And we had the shocking information delivered that they can put out, a single cow can put out 600 liters of methane in a day. And it cuts by an incredible amount when they put about 15% or something into their food, seaweed, that is.
Isn't that wonderful? And the cows are healthy, right?
Yeah, they're doing great. I mean, past a certain point of diet, it gets to where they don't particularly like the food very much, but they figured out the level where it's good for the cow and good for the planet as well.
Right.
We are talking to Susan Hand Shetterly about her book, Seaweed Chronicles, A World at the Water's Edge. You can join the conversation on the exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Looks like with the arsenic, you've already answered one listener's question about whether there are any toxic seaweeds. And then Peter in Ashland wants to know about the implications of pollution and microplastics on seaweed, if you've done some research on that.
I have to tell you, I don't know about microplastics, but that's an excellent question. The other question about pollution.
Mm-hmm.
Seaweeds will take in whatever's in the water, and that's good and also bad. And one thing I wrote about was a species of seaweed that people were using in their fish tanks that got into the Mediterranean. It's toxic, and not many organisms in the Mediterranean eat that seaweed. As a matter of fact, I've read that there's only one, and it's a fish. But anyhow, what happens is that seaweed, which is not native to the Mediterranean, spreads very quickly. And it has spread through the Mediterranean. But here's the thing. The people who are managing harbors, and there are a lot of big commercial harbors in the Mediterranean, like that seaweed, because that seaweed takes in so many toxins that it makes the water much cleaner. The problem with seaweed that takes in toxins, if we do it purposefully. It's called, what is it called, FICA remediation. That means using seaweeds to clean up a bay. Where do you put the seaweeds afterwards? You can't eat them. You can't put them on a farm field. What in heaven's name do you do with them? And that's a problem.
Oh, I can see that. Yes, yeah. What you do with the stuff that has actually filtered out the bad things, but it's got the bad things themselves in them.
Right.
So I was surprised to find that, you know, for even people think like, yeah, I'd never eat seaweed, it's in some of the products we use already. What kinds of things, Susan?
Well, it's in an awful lot of processed food. Sometimes, not in all yogurts, but it can be found in yogurts and soy milk. It can be in tofu, cottage cheese. It's in makeup, pet food, soil amendments. A lot of the big industrial farms out in the Midwest are now buying a certain kind of seaweed. It's called Ascophyllum or knotted rack, that has been processed. It's grown here in the Atlantic. It's processed, and it's mixed with other composting, soil-enriching ingredients and spread over those fields. And what they tell us is when they're using seaweed, they don't have to use so many chemicals. And that's great. But here's the downside. I mean, just think that the seaweed is being taken from the Atlantic, taken halfway across this country, and put on these enormous commercial farms. I just wonder if there's a better way to do it. But I'm glad they're doing it. It seems as if maybe they could figure out something that's closer to home.
Right.
But that's just me.
Right. It gets into the local food thing. We want your food to travel less distance. And,
exactly. Right. And also it gets into over-harvest because they need lots.
Right. Which is why I was asking the question about sustainability earlier. Let us take a call. We have Al in Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Susan Hand Shetterly, the author of Seaweed Chronicles. Hi, Al.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. Good show. Yeah, my question to your guest is, I've seen videos of the ocean floor in the Atlantic and in the Pacific and also in the Red Sea and the Arabian Gulf, where there is no seaweed whatsoever. It's almost like a desert. I wonder why it's in some places you see it very prevalent and other places it's not. I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you, Al. So what does seaweed require to grow is the basic question, I guess, Susan.
Right. That's a great question because you would find that in the Gulf of Maine, too. So on muddy bottoms, there's nothing for seaweed to attach to. And remember, it has to attach or it can't, it has to attach firmly or it can't lift itself easily up toward the sun. So if it's muddy, the seaweeds are not going to grow there. If it is hard-packed sand, where in some places in the world there is that kind of a bottom, seaweeds, there are a few species of seaweeds that can make these rhizome-like holds into the sand and kind of anchor themselves that way. But in general, what you need for seaweed is rocks or corals or seashells, something hard, some hard surface for them to anchor to. But that's an excellent question. But may I take it one step farther?
Sure.
So when the people who are doing the aquaculture farms here in the Gulf of Maine, and this is a very new endeavor for us, we're figuring out which bays are good for growing seaweeds and which aren't, which species of seaweeds like which bays. I mean, it's all match-up. But they never grow the seaweeds over the rocks that have the wild seaweeds. They always take them to a place where there's a mud bottom and there's no seaweed growing. And then they stretch their ropes out and they have some of the lines of the ropes going down. And they grow their seaweeds in a place where they're not interfering with wild seaweeds.
Which is, I presume, a good thing.
It's excellent.
All right. We have much more to talk about seaweed. We haven't even really talked about the other creatures around seaweed, which are many, obviously. And now we have to get into that in the next segment with Susan Hand Shetterly. Her book is called Seaweed Chronicles, A World at the Water's Edge. We're learning so much about seaweed and the fact that, A, it's not a plant, it's a microalgae. B, kelp is seaweed, and there's a whole alphabet left of stuff to learn here. Seaweed Chronicles, A World at the Water's Edge. Susan Hand Shetterly, again, our guest. You can join the conversation by phone or by email when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment of today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the essayist Susan Hand Shetterly. She's actually written quite a few books, including several aimed at children. She lives in rural Maine and works to save habitat there. She's written a book about seaweed called Seaweed Chronicles, A World at the Water's Edge. It is fascinating, the things we didn't know about seaweed, many of which we then learned from reading this book. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. Your questions and comments about your experiences with seaweeds or just things you want to know. Welcome on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We have a question from Joy in Talent, who wants to know, is taking kelp tablets the same beneficially as eating seaweed?
That's interesting.
Because you can take the kelp supplement tablets, that sort of thing.
Right, right. The reason I'm pausing is I'm going to say two things. One is, I don't know. But two is, I would think it would be more or less the same.
Okay. All right, fair enough. The I want to come back to some, we were talking about the holdfasts that that seaweed need to hold fast to something underneath them, and it helps to be rocks, shells, corals, something like that, which raises the question then what the general state of seaweed is, particularly in areas where seaweed attaches to coral, since coral seems to be doing so badly in so many of the world's oceans.
Right. Well, the way it used to work would be that there were species of seaweeds that attached to corals, and there was a species of fish that ate that seaweed. That was their food. So they'd always be cleaning off the corals, and then the seaweeds would be growing again for food for the fish. And it worked. But now, you're very right, with the heat, with the bleaching, and the things can get so disrupted, and also because of overfishing, that the seaweeds can grow over the corals, and of course, that will do them in. Here is what I think I've learned over these 5 years, and I really have had an apprenticeship with these wonderful people who've taken me out in the water and patiently taught me things. And it is this: if we want wild nature, and I don't think we can live without it, we need to actively take care of it better. And because wild can't do it on its own anymore. And that's a shocking thing to say, but I think it's true.
And there are some great essays in the book about things like the collapse of the cod fishery that I do want to get to. There's a particular part about a place called Cash's Ledge, and I felt like I was looking at a unicorn sighting as I read that chapter. What's going on at Cash's Ledge, and why is the place so important?
Well, thank you so much for asking that question, because I love talking about Cash's Ledge. It is just very simply this mountain range of 25 miles in the middle of the Gulf of Maine. Actually, it's off the coast of Massachusetts. The Gulf of Maine runs from Cape Cod right up to Canada to Nova Scotia. But anyhow, the thing that's exciting about Cash's Ledge for so many scientists is that it lifts right up in the water so that sunlight does penetrate down to its sides. And they find there what they imagine the Gulf of Maine looked like with the first white contact. They find huge schools of cod. They find halibut. They find haddock. They find tuna and whales. And this, it's all in this broth of enormous kelps, just drifting back and forth with the currents. And they go down and take pictures of it. And you can look online, and you'll fall in love with the place. I mean, the colors, the amount of life there, everybody's eating everybody else, and the seaweeds are like a jungle. And so what scientists would really like, I mean, how could you not want this if you're a scientist, is to preserve this place as much as possible.
What are the projections there now, Susan?
Well, there are some. There are, you're allowed to fish there under certain restrictions, and there's sport fishing that still goes on there. But the people who are working at Cache's Ledge would prefer none of that, because their argument is this: if this place is one of the few jewels in the crown of the Gulf of Maine, and there are a number, but this is really special, why not have it completely off limits to all kinds of harvest, if anything? Because as the fish, for instance, thrive there, they're going to be moving out there, and the fishermen will be getting these beautiful fish. So it's not that the fishermen won't be getting them. They just have to wait until there are enough of them so that the fish enlarge the area where they swim. And also, now with climate change, the scientists believe that they need a control. In other words, they need Cache's Ledge to look at to see how, if we keep things as healthy as we can, how a healthy place like Cache's Ledge might adapt to climate change, and whether it would do so a whole lot better than compromised places in the ocean.
For the folks who are wondering what we're talking about and want to go look it up, it's spelled like cash, like money, E-S, Cache's Ledge, and the Conservation Law Foundation and other groups are working to protect the place. So, and you mentioned that, and this is the reason that it was like a unicorn sighting to read about Cache's Ledge, to hear that there are cod there, because cod does get its own chapter in the book, appropriately, called Ghost Fish. I mean, how big a crash has this been of the cod fishery in the Atlantic?
Well, it's commercially extinct, so that means it's affected our life here and the lives of fishermen.
I guess I'm always confused about, you know, why people would think the supply was inexhaustible and why nobody seemed to change behavior when it was clear that there was something happening.
Well, there's the big question that we are asking ourselves about ourselves. Isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
But here's the thing. I wrote in the book, I mean, I was stunned. So I love to eat cod. So maybe about once a year or twice a year, I go, I haven't done it recently. So I was going to the local fish market, and I was buying some cod. And just for the heck of it, I said, where does this cod come from? Assuming I'd be told Newfoundland, or off the coast of Nova Scotia, or even in the Gulf of Maine, it was Pacific cod. So what they were doing was catching them in the Pacific. I think you may have better regulations there. I'm not sure about that. But they were catching them in the Pacific, flying them across the country, and my little fish store was buying them and selling them to me. How crazy is that?
Yeah, that is not local food by any stretch of the imagination.
No.
So do biologists think that cod ever could get back to their historic numbers? I mean, do they get hope from places like Cache's Ledge?
Well, in my book, I have two opinions. One of them is given by Ted Ames. I mean, these people, when I was writing the book, were so patient, and they were so knowledgeable. I cannot say enough about them. But he has worked his whole life to try to figure out what happened to the cod population and if we might get it back. And he's come up with the idea, in a nutshell, after all these years of studying, that if we can open up our streams and rivers so that we can have species of herring that are anadromous, meaning they spawn up in lakes and they come down the rivers and they spend the winter, the young ones do, in the bay below the streams where they've migrated, that the cod were actually feeding on those fish. We call them alewives here.
Mm-hmm.
And so he feels that if we can reestablish the runs of alewives, and people have stepped up in small towns. Surrey, where I live, is one town. We worked for 8 years, and now we've got this beautiful fish ladder, and the alewives are coming in like crazy, and they're going up and spawning. So we're doing our part, and Ted believes that the overlay between the alewives and the cod is very important. He also believes that even though it's commercially extinct, there are enough cod in the Gulf of Maine so that we do have a chance, if we can reestablish what their food needs are, to get them somewhat back. But another person who is also a biologist, later on in the book, says the Gulf of Maine has changed too much and it's too warm. And he said, I don't think we'll ever get them back. So these are two very intelligent people who've done a lot of studying on it, and they don't agree. And that happens a lot.
I can imagine. Do cod have a relationship to seaweed in the food chain?
Well, they do in a wonderful way that Ted Ames was explaining to me. Is, first of all, they'll come into bays, or I'm talking about when there were more of them. They would come into bays, and they would feed on the young alewives that have just come down the rivers to spend the winters in the deeper part of the bays. And those young alewives are hiding in the seaweeds. And also, there's a lot of food for them around the seaweeds. And so the cod would come in and feed on them. And the cod would often spawn near seaweeds. And the young codfish would use the seaweeds the same way the alewives did to find food and also shelter. And then as they grew, they'd go outside the seaweeds to bigger areas, and then they'd come back, and they'd eat the smaller fish in the seaweeds. So it seems to be circular.
It does. It's like going to the seaweed was going to the grocery store for the cod.
Exactly.
And the maternity ward, for that matter, too.
That's right.
The hiding in seaweed part is interesting because it seems like seaweed is such important habitat for so many creatures. And you tell the story in the book about what happened to otters on the West Coast when the kelp began disappearing. And it's just an interesting chain of events that actually involved whaling from 50 years ago. Can you explain that connection?
Well, I can try to explain it, but do help me out here because you can get lost in the seaweed weeds trying to explain this. that we are not talking about the population of orcas that are having trouble now because of the lack of salmon.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the population. They're all distinct. There's a different population called the transient population. It comes up from the Gulf of Mexico all the way up, and it comes, not the Gulf of Mexico.
Gulf of California.
Baja. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, Gulf of California.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it comes all the they travel all the way up to southern Alaska. So they go right by where you are. They actually don't eat salmon. Well, I would imagine if one flew by, I mean swam by them, they might take a nibble, but they actually were whale killers, and they were preying on the baleen whales, which are not the toothed whales. They were preying on the gray whales or the humpbacks or some of the smaller whales like that, that would go north also with their young. And so they were more like a wolf pack, these orcas. But they found that the orcas were starting to eat harbor seals, and you have quite a few different kinds of seals. There's stellar sea lions, and others. And then people were telling the scientists that they saw orcas picking up otters. And the scientists would not believe that because it would be like one piece of popcorn for an orca.
Right, but I have to shorten the story here because we're almost out of time. But essentially,
help me shorten it.
It's because the baleen whales were not there because they had been harvested. That the orcas had to go after the smaller prey like the otters. So everything that gets done by humans in the oceans has a ripple effect, which is well reflected in the book Seaweed Chronicles: A World at the Water's Edge. It's the work of Susan Hans Shetterly. Susan, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, and thank you for helping me out there.
Sure, take care.